Welcome, and thank you for joining NIAC Virtual Talks, SIPs to Arbitration, Can We Be Friends? Before we get started, I would like to cover a few housekeeping items. Today's session is being recorded. You will receive a follow-up email with a link to view the recording. We welcome you to revisit the content at any time and share it with colleagues. For anyone seeking CLE credit, I'll provide a password during the presentation. Following the webinar, a brief survey will appear in your browser where you may enter your information to receive CLE credit. All attendees will be muted during the session. You will have the opportunity to submit text questions by typing them into the question and answer pane of your Zoom control panel, and we will aim to answer it during the Q&A portion of today's webinar. If you have any technology issues, please use the Q&A box as well, and I will assist you. Lastly, the opinions expressed in this webinar are solely of the participants and do not reflect the opinions and beliefs of their organizations or affiliates unless expressed explicitly. I want to also thank the New York International Arbitration Center for producing the NIAC Talk Series and providing a platform for Nira and Winston and Strawn to share their interesting insights on this timely topic. And with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Christine Meyer.
Hello, welcome to NIAC's webinar entitled SCPs to Arbitration, Can We Be Friends? My name is Christine Meyer. I serve as chair of NIRA's intellectual property practice. I'm a frequent testifying expert in litigation and arbitration. One of my favorite parts of this work is learning about cutting-edge technologies. And since in the last year, I've learned both about viruses and vaccines, well, that is computer viruses, but plant-based vaccines, I'm always well-positioned to contribute to the Zoom version of a cocktail party, that friendly banter while we're waiting for everyone to join. Let me introduce my panelists. Aldo Bandini is one of the two co-chairs of Winston and Strawn's Technology Antitrust Group. You have them both here today, and I'll introduce the other in a second. Aldo is the first chair trial lawyer who has been doing antitrust cases and international arbitration since the 1980s and patent cases since the 1990s. And he specializes, as the group title suggests, in the IP antitrust intersection. His current hobby, as we were discussing actually in the pre-Zoom banter, is nurturing his heirloom tomato plants along. Suzanne Torpy is the other co-chair of Winston Strawn's Tech Antitrust Group. Susanna has more than 15 years of experience successfully litigating high-profile antitrust, IP, and tech issues through trials, appeals, and at the Supreme Court. Susanna and Aldo have both litigated numerous antitrust cases related to SEP licensing and FRAND. One fun fact about Susanna is that she has taken and defended dozens of depositions during the pandemic in fuzzy animal-themed slipper socks that her kids gave her. And I salute that. Terrific. Dr. Sheng Li is an associate director at NIRA, where he applies his expertise to assist clients in high-stakes IP, antitrust, and class action litigations. Sheng earned his PhD in economics from UC Berkeley, and he has provided expert report and deposition testimony in U.S. District Court. His favorite activity, outside of economic analysis, of course, is playing peekaboo with his six-month-old daughter. And Christopher Bushi is a director at NIRA's intellectual property practice. His practice focuses on IP damage quantification and valuation. He testifies on IP damages and other issues in U.S. District Court and in arbitration. He has weathered the pandemic in rural Piedmont, Virginia, and has used the extra time gained from no commute to work on a variety of outdoor projects and continued his research on all aspects of IP valuation. As Pam mentioned, just a reminder that the views expressed during this webinar are those of the individual panelists, not necessarily the views of our respective employers or of our clients. Also, because of the time constraints, we will be talking about some general observations, but of course, every case and situation is unique. So what we say here may or may not apply to other fact patterns. So let me give you a general overview. Here you can see what we're going to be talking about in today's webinar. And since we have a lot to cover, let me dive right into it. We're going to begin by talking about when you might see arbitration in disputes involving FRAND issues. But Christopher, just so that our audience members who come from different jurisdictions and with different levels of experience all understand what we mean when we talk about FRAND, can you please explain what FRAND licensing is and how it arises?
Sure. FRAND, which stands for Fair, Reasonable, and Non-Discriminatory, relates to patent license obligations for declared standard and essential patents, which we'll refer to as SEPs. When standard-setting bodies consider which standards to adopt, member entities are usually required to offer FRAND licensing terms as a condition for adopting patented technology of that entity as part of the standard. As you can imagine, parties often disagree as to what is fair, what is reasonable, and what is non-discriminatory. They also often disagree on which patents are actually standard and essential. However, because the patent holder has agreed to license SEP patents, it's been very difficult to obtain an injunction in both the U.S. and non-U.S. jurisdictions.
Great. So here, obviously, we have a forum involving international arbitration. So Shane, can you tell us a little bit about when you've seen arbitration clauses specifically related to FRAND issues?
Sure. So what we have seen is arbitration clauses come up in the context of antitrust concerns. And what we have seen is regulators in both US, Europe, and Asia have, we've seen them push for binding arbitration clauses in SEP licensing or SEP licensing as a way to resolve FRAND disputes. Now to unpack this relationship between antitrust and SEP licensing, let me first give a brief overview of two issues that come up in standard central patent licensing that could lead to antitrust concerns. And these issues are patent holdup and patent holdout. Patent holdup occurs when the owner of standard essential patent attempts to charge royalty rates that are higher than what they could have obtained before the patent was included in the standard. So it will be the claim would be is higher than the FRAND rate. An example of this could be if you imagine a product that has been developed to use, let's say, Bluetooth standard communications. Once it has been developed, it may be costly to retool and redesign and to recertify the product to use Wi-Fi instead of Bluetooth, even though the overall cost of using either Bluetooth or Wi-Fi could have been similar if they had started from the beginning. Now, patent holdup comes up if a bad actor that owns Bluetooth standard central patents try to take advantage of these switching costs to overcharge the implementer. Patent holdout is sort of the opposite side of this, and it occurs when a alleged infringer ignores patents and resists patent owner demands because the odds of getting caught, they think that might be small, or they think they can drag out the legal proceedings. And this is often discussed in the context of situations where patent injunctions are difficult to obtain or enforce. To be clear, neither patent holdup or patent holdout are automatically antitrust problems, but they can attract antitrust scrutiny when the entities may have market power or market power is involved. So for patent holdup, the analogy to antitrust will be monopolization type claims because they are a owner or a seller of the technology. And for patent holdout, it's more linked to things like monopsony where the implementer is a buyer, or you might consider them a powerful buyer of the technology. So getting to back to your original question about where we have seen arbitration come up. So in the US, the FTC in a 2013 consent order with Google, the FTC was concerned with Google engaging in patent holdup to raise competitors' costs relating to standard central patent that they acquired through Motorola. In the consent order, Google agreed to offer potential licensees binding arbitration before seeking an injunction when the standard central patent licensings break down. In European Union, similar industry, 2014, they investigated Samsung for infringing their competition laws when Samsung was seeking injunctions against implementers of 3G technology for standard central patents. And Samsung agreed to a five-year commitment to not seek injunctions for smartphones and to resolve FRAND disputes in court or, if both parties agree, by an arbitrator. same time frame, the Chinese competition authorities were also looking into this. So there was a merger between Microsoft and Nokia, again, in the handset space. The Chinese authorities were concerned that this could create antitrust issues. So as part of the conditional approval for that merger, the Chinese regulator required Nokia to define good faith or willingness to license as a matter of each party's willingness to resolve the issues for FRAND terms through binding arbitration. So again, they're pushing on that front. I'll just briefly mention that although the investigations that I mentioned, they focus more on the patent hold up side, they can also alleviate patent hold out issues. And this is because having the arbitration clause gives the standard central patent owner a clear path and timeline to obtain an injunction if the implementer rejects the arbitration or the arbitrator's decision. So now that I've gone through these sort of examples, I have a question for the lawyers on the panel. And I guess based on these examples from the US, EU, and China, are antitrust regulators using binding arbitration clauses in standard central patent licensing to create a type of due process requirement before injunctions can be evoked? And I guess maybe this is a question for you, Susanna. Is this consistent with what you've seen in your work involving FRAND obligations? And do you see different jurisdictions taking different approaches to the antitrust issues for FRAND licensing?
Thank you, Feng. So what we are seeing is not so much a due process requirement, because you would have to persuade a court to order an injunction, which presumably would satisfy due process. Instead, what we are seeing in the rise of arbitration provisions as a remedy in FRAND disputes is an acknowledgement that having to litigate which patents are being infringed by which implementers in which countries, and then having to determine a FRAND rate, is expensive, inefficient, and could take years. Perceived advantages across jurisdictions have led to complex procedural issues that can add years onto litigation even before getting to a FRAND determination. So for example, how this plays out in practice is that a patent holder will sue in Germany, where it is more likely to get an injunction, but then the implementer, or in one of our cases, even the supplier to that implementer, will sue in another jurisdiction like the United States and try to get that court to issue an anti-suit injunction to enjoin the patent holder from suing in Germany. In our case, the supplier first sued in California, but then we were successful in transferring the case to another jurisdiction. Then we had to litigate and defeat the motion for an anti-suit injunction before even getting to the motion to dismiss. Meanwhile, in Germany, the patent holder was able to obtain an anti-suit injunction. Then after all of that time had passed, at the motion to dismiss stage, the Department of Justice filed a statement of interest agreeing with our position, which the judge adopted, that a breach of FRAND in the United States is a contract issue and not an antitrust issue, unlike in other jurisdictions. These differences across jurisdictions will lead to a complex mix of antitrust, IP, and contract claim litigation in different jurisdictions around the world, absent either a major international convergence, which is highly unlikely to occur anytime soon, or a greater focus by SSOs and private parties on incorporating arbitration provisions into FRAND agreements.
Thank you, Suzanne. Following your discussion about some of those interesting cross-border issues, in that case, it left my head spinning where the suit and anti-suit and anti-anti-suit injunctions were landing. Aldo, can you maybe back up for a moment and just give us a little big picture context on the legal framework in the United States for when FRAND issues are resolved in national courts versus international arbitration?
Sure. First of all, thank you folks for taking part of your summer to be with us. I'm good at the big picture. Susanna's good at the details. But what's interesting about the situations that Cheng talked about, if you guys were listening carefully, is that there were regulators that were forcing the parties into arbitration with the threat overhanging of an enforcement action of some sort if they didn't arbitrate. Of course, there has to be an agreement to arbitrate. In that case, where the regulators forced you, they were forced into an agreement to arbitrate. But normally, an implementer of a standard and the patent owner don't have an agreement to arbitrate. So, absent that agreement, you can't force an entity to arbitrate unless they agree to do so. So that's point number one. And where the agreement comes from raises some complex questions. Normally, it's not done beforehand. SSOs, standard setting organizations, could think about making it part of their policies to compel arbitration. They haven't done that yet. The next sort of big picture issue is, okay, you've decided to arbitrate. What is the governing law and where are you going to arbitrate? What's the situs of the arbitration? I had an arbitration a couple of years ago where the situs was actually a very important issue because of this concept that's often described in Latin to make it sound fancy, but I'll probably mispronounce it, lex loci or lex loci arbitri, which basically says the locus of the arbitration. And sometimes arbitrators will apply the law of the locus of the arbitration to procedural issues. So even if you think you've got it all buttoned up and have chosen the substantive law of a jurisdiction you like, if you're arbitrating somewhere else, there's a risk that, at least for procedural issues, you're going to get a different law applied. So what is the attitude of US courts to arbitration of FRAND issues? I have to say that given all the complexities Susanna's been talking about, there is nothing more than US judges would love to see than for parties to take this problem out of their courtrooms and to arbitrate them. There are very complex procedural issues with anti-suit injunctions and jurisdiction, choice of law, and there are very complex substantive issues, and Cheng is going to talk a little bit about those later. So judges do not reach out to get these cases, but sometimes they land in their lap, right? And one interesting case that Christopher is going to talk a little bit about more later was Judge Selna's decision in the Central District of California in the TCL versus Ericsson case. And TCL and Ericsson got into a dispute about what was FRAND and whether FRAND offers had been made by Ericsson to TCL for standard essential patents. And Judge Selna delivered a very long, interesting opinion, which I hasten to add was overturned on appeal, but not on substantive grounds. It was overturned on appeal because the appellate court said it should have been tried to a jury because damages were at stake. But the approach of Judge Selna is illustrative for a number of reasons. He echoes some themes that also appear in other cases. First, he says, in order to negotiate in good faith, your initial offer need not be FRAND. Well, that's an interesting concept. So you can maybe, if Judge Selna is right, maybe you can start high if you're the patent holder and offer something that may not be FRAND, but if you're negotiating in good faith and you eventually get to FRAND, maybe that's good enough. He also says FRAND can be more than one rate. You know, that may be counterintuitive because part of the FRAND definition, as Cheng said, is non-discriminatory. But what does discriminatory mean? Selna seems to think that there may be different circumstances that different implementers are facing that might justify different FRAND rates for different implementers. So one rate for all is not necessarily Fran. But the really interesting thing that's relevant to this panel is Judge Selma's approach to arbitration. Even though he obviously issued a legal decision, he went out of his way to say that these types of disputes, where possible, should be arbitrated. And there's a public policy in favor of arbitration. And in fact, TCL somehow got a hold of an earlier arbitration decision, which was either made public or it got in discovery, where Erickson had a decision about the FRAND rate for these very patents. And TCL was seeking to preclude Erickson as a matter of collateral estoppel from questioning that rate, that was the rate imposed by the arbitrator. And Selma said no. Selma said, first of all, I'm not sure the issues are exactly the same, but moreover, there's this public policy in favor of arbitration, and we don't want to hinder arbitration by having a draconian collateral estoppel rule that would discourage arbitration. And finally, the other interesting thing, echoing what Susanna said, is that he also went out of his way to say that a FRAND breach is not necessarily an antitrust breach. It may just be a contract breach, which is a hotly disputed topic. But that's the basic overview, Christine, of how U.S. courts have approached this.
Great, thanks, Aldo. Appreciate that summary. So now we understand what FRAND is. We understand how it can arise in arbitration. Let's talk a little bit about sort of strategy. What are the benefits of arbitration versus taking this to a court from the standpoint of the patent holders, the users of the technology, other stakeholders? I mean, we just heard that at least this one judge was wanted to encourage arbitration. So let's start with Christopher, and then maybe we'll get the legal perspective on this as well. Christopher, you want to start us off on?
Sure. There are several benefits that are often listed for using arbitration rather than the courts. And I say often listed because I don't know that a lot of these stand up when you really look at it. And one is the confidentiality of outcomes, including license agreements. Second would be perceived neutrality of the arbitrators. And I think anyone who's been involved in arbitration, sometimes the panel, you know, arbitrators are very much neutral, sometimes not so much. And then speed of the arbitration. I think the real economic benefit is definitely due to the streamlined process, which translates into just simple cost savings. However, the streamlined process can also result in a lot less discovery. And with that comes a lot more information that's just not known by either side. Along with the economic benefits, so there are also many legal benefits to the parties. And I'll turn this over to Aldo to discuss the legal and strategic impacts.
Sure. Thank you, Christopher. Let's talk about what you said are the listed benefits. And you're right, Christopher, some of them may be to some extent illusory. Confidentiality is one of them. Yes, arbitrations are confidential for the most part. But as you saw in the TCL Erickson case I just talked about, somehow TCL got a hold of the previous Erickson arbitration award. And I should have mentioned, by the way, that finally, after all these years, TCL and Erickson announced this past Friday that they have resolved their SEP disputes. So it will not be getting retried after all. So confidentiality is a benefit. There is at least a greater chance that you can keep the decision confidential in arbitration than it is in a public court setting. More limited discovery, in theory. And here I would like to get on my soapbox and make a pitch for really being careful about drafting your arbitration clauses. because you will not get more limited discovery unless you pay attention when you're drafting your arbitration clauses. I have been involved in an arbitration that was supposed to be a JAMS fast track arbitration, which, you know, cradle to grave was supposed to last something like 9 months. It was brought in 2013. We just are awaiting a decision on preliminary threshold issues some 9 years later, right? Or whatever it is. So it's very important that the parties sit down and agree on what discovery will be allowed and what won't be allowed. The third advantage is a potential for a more sophisticated decision maker, right? Judges in the US may know the law, but they don't necessarily know the details of technology at issue, whether a patent is essential or not. There are lots of sophisticated issues. And if the parties want, they can specify ahead of time that an expert or a team of experts are going to decide that issue. The next benefit is probably, in my view, the most significant benefit, which is, as folks have already hinted about this issue, and we're going to discuss it a little more in a minute. If you want your FRAND dispute resolved on a worldwide basis, you are more likely to get that in an arbitration. There is a notable reluctance in US courts to get involved with foreign patents and foreign royalty rates, understandably. There are different legal regimes. They have enough issues with dealing with US patents. They don't want to deal with foreign patents. There was a 2007 Federal Circuit decision in the Voda versus Cordes case that said it's almost always an abuse of discretion to decide infringement for a US court to decide infringement issues of foreign patents. Now, that concept has been extended to FRAND issues. I mean, courts have said, citing Voda, you know, if we're not going to decide infringement of foreign patents, we're certainly not going to decide FRAND issues relating to foreign patents, including a couple of decisions out of the Eastern District of Texas, which have said that. Now, those of you who know the Eastern District of Texas know that that court is not shy to exercise jurisdiction whenever it can, but even that court has said, not us, we're not gonna do FRAND on foreign patents. So what's the bottom line? My bottom line advice would be, if you are trying to get a court, or you're trying to get a dispute rather, resolved with a worldwide FRAND determination, you are more likely to have success with an arbitrator than with a court. Although some courts have been a little braver, and you'll hear about this a little later, the UK has been a little braver and has put their toe in those waters. But so far, I really haven't seen a lot of appetite in the US to do that. Christine, back
Thanks,
to you.
Thanks, Thanks, Aldo. Yeah, so, you know, thanks, and you spoke really and gave us a good overview of the TCL Ericsson decision, but, you know, also a quick jaunt around Google in these and legal writings in these areas brings up the Unwired Planet and Huawei case. And so I was wondering, Christopher, if you might take us on a little bit of a tour through that case, because that brings up some interesting cross-border issues that touch on exactly the same sorts of issues that we've been talking about.
Sure, I'll even bring you on a broader tour. The outside of international arbitration, courts of several countries have shown they are ready to set royalty rates. One potential problem with national courts becoming involved in SEP rate setting is forum shopping, where the licensor or licensee files litigation in a court system that it views as being most favorable to its position. The dispute between Samsung and Ericsson was a great illustration of forum shopping, where Samsung used Chinese courts to obtain an anti-suit injunction against Ericsson that sought to prevent Ericsson from seeking relief on its 4G and 5G SEPs anywhere else in the world. That didn't stop Ericsson, though, from filing suit in the U.S. court. And this was really shaping up to be a great battle. However, both of the parties recently settled. A lot of issues were not decided, but it is a good example of forum shopping and using the Chinese courts to obtain an anti-suit injunction. A little bit more on TCL versus Ericsson, which was originally decided in 2017, as Aldo said by Judge Selina. This was the first time that a U.S. District Court determined a FRAND rate for an entire standard essential patent portfolio. And in this case, when negotiations broke down, both parties agreed to engage in binding court adjudication of the terms for a worldwide portfolio license. So in a sense, TCL and Ericsson is closer to an arbitration where both parties kind of agree on the venue. And the judge in this case determined that Ericsson was not offering TCL FRAND licensing terms. But as Aldo mentioned, this was overturned by the Fed Circuit. And has eventually settled. And what was overturned was that Ericsson was entitled to a jury trial on the question of whether it offered the FRAND terms. But as Christine mentioned, an interesting case is the Unwired Planet versus Huawei. In August of 2020, the UK Supreme Court issued its ruling rejecting appeals of Huawei in a FRAND licensing dispute brought by Unwired Planet. In its decision, the UK court found that while the question of validity and infringement of patents are determined by courts of the country that granted those patents, the contractual relationship created by, in this case, the European Telecommunications Standard Institute, or ETSI, under its intellectual property rights policy, and this is a quote, gave the English court's jurisdiction to determine the terms of a license of a portfolio of patents, which includes foreign patents. Further, the court found that it has the power to issue a so-called FRAND injunction. The UK court held that, quote, Chinese courts do not currently have the jurisdiction needed to determine the terms of a global FRAND license without the agreement by the parties. So commentators have said that decisions such as Unwired Planet encourage forum shopping for FRAND litigation by both implementers and SEP owners. Susanna, have you seen this in your practice?
So I'll just say, I don't think it's fair to pin forum shopping on the Unwired Planet decision, because forum shopping was already a central feature of FRAND litigation well before that decision in 2020. Plus, the Unwired Planet case is actually not so unique. It was already following the logic of the Microsoft versus Motorola decisions in the Ninth Circuit from almost a decade earlier, holding that a global FRAND rate can be set and enforced if, unlike the cases Aldo discussed, if it's based on a contractual FRAND commitment. The court was really focused on the problem that without an injunction, implementers can force patent holders to litigate patent by patent and country by country until the cost is simply too high to enforce their rights. While the Unwired Planet decision does provide some hope for litigation to address these issues, this ruling really turns on the interpretation of the specific relevant FRAND commitment and the specific facts of this case. But really, as a practical matter, if an implementer still wanted to refuse to accept a global license, it could choose to be excluded from the UK market or to implement a workaround to UK patents. In the end, the decision can't fully resolve these issues unless other jurisdictions agree that patent rates can be set and enforced globally, that the initial rate that was set was correct, and that another jurisdiction itself isn't a better forum to resolve the dispute. And as we have seen in China, China has issued a number of anti-suit injunctions barring enforcement of foreign injunctions. And China has gone even further in holding that it has jurisdiction to set a global franc rate, even without an underlying contract, on the basis that merely implementing the patents in China is sufficient. In one of these suits that was referenced, the Texas court then issued an anti-suit injunction on the basis that comedy would not be offended by both suits proceeding in parallel at the same time. So the bottom line is that the putative ability to set a global franc rate in litigation may actually make matters worse in some cases and leaves open a substantial upside for arbitration.
Great, thank you, Susanna. So let's turn and talk a little bit about licensing and royalty considerations, since we have two accomplished, two accomplished economic panelists to talk about these issues. So maybe Christopher, maybe you can start off. What do you see as some of the significant licensing and royalty rate considerations that would need to be considered in a rate setting exercise by an IA panel, if we're talking about the world of FRAND?
Sure. Patent holders are usually concerned that their patents are given the proper level of significance compared to other patents that are part of the relevant standard, right? They want their fair share of the royalty pie. Implementers are almost always concerned that the royalty slice of the pie doesn't become the entire pie. If you look at the number of entities claiming to have standard essential patents for any given standard and the total number of patents claimed, you can see why licensees are very concerned about royalty stacking, where royalty on royalty for different entities are stacked on each other, leaving only a very small slice of profitability left for the implementer. Parties will be aware of prior generation standards, claimed SEPs, and licensing terms. These will all be relevant data points when determining rates for new SEPs. Citation analysis can often be used to determine the relevant value of patent technology included in the standard. In this way, prior licenses can help inform the value of patents in a new standard. Other considerations would include rate structure for different countries, license terms, and so on.
Thanks, Christopher. I'm sure, you know, you, as all of us who have worked in the area of royalty rate determination know, you could probably have a whole seminar, if not several, just on that. So thanks for getting us through the sort of the high level considerations. And maybe we'll come back to some of that in the Q&A if we have time. Sheng, I'd ask you to please sort of comment and expand a little bit on a phrase that Christopher used, which was royalty stacking. We hear about this a lot in high-tech cases. I think it dovetails with some of the things that you were talking about before. What are some of the ways, can you just sort of walk us through what royalty stacking is, what the concern is, and then ways in which it can be addressed?
Right. So royalty stacking, it refers to this issue where to implement a standard, because especially the more high-tech standards, there are hundreds, sometimes thousands of patents in a standard. Unlike the more simpler IP issues where you go to one patent owner, you get a license and you're scot-free. With a standard central patent, you might need to get separate licenses from 3, 4, 5, 7, 8 different entities. You need need a license to everything that's in the standard in order to implement the standard. And an issue is that you start paying one piece of royalty here, another piece of royalty there, you stack up 10 different sets of royalties that you're paying. And the concern is that at the end of the day, you're paying something that's greater than the value of the standard as a whole, because each of the patent owners, they just want to maybe get the highest rate that they can get, which is, that's their economic incentives. Right. So but where this comes down to FRAND is FRAND quite clearly specifies that the overall royalty that you're supposed to pay for a standard essential patent as a package should not include the value the value that the patent owners get from including the standard or including their patent in the standard as being standard essential. So what you want to do is evaluate the appropriate royalty for the technology as a whole, so that you get a cap for the overall stack. So in 3G or 4G, when they talk about apportionment, the first step in apportionment is you figure out the total royalties that are appropriate FRAND royalties for the entire standard. And then you portion down into the individual standard central patent owners. And there's different methods for doing that. One method is the top-down approach, which was also adopted by Judge Selna in the TCL versus Ericsson case. So again, the first step is they get a measure of the aggregate royalty for the standard. And then the basic version of top-down apportionment is you just get the count of valid standard central patents in the whole standard. And that's you get a denominator, and then you figure out how many standard central patents are at issue in the case. So that's a numerator. So for example, if you had one of 100 patents for the standard, the apportionment would just be 1/100. It's a fairly simplistic approach that essentially treats every single patent in the standard as equal. They have equal weights. That has been used, but obviously, if you think about it, there's some issues. Not all patents are equal. Something that Christopher mentioned earlier is patent citation analysis, and that's a more sophisticated method of apportionment. Instead of treating all the patents with just equal weights, you assign weights to each patent based on the number of times that patent has been cited by other patents. So there's a fairly robust academic literature that shows there's a strong positive relationship between citations and the value and the contributions of those patents. Now, to do this properly, you also need to adjust for the other factors, such as like the age of the patent and the technological field. That gets into fairly detailed discussion. I'm happy to talk offline if people have questions. But that's I guess a bit of flavor for what goes into the royalty stacking and the apportionment methods that can be used to deal with that.
Christine, can I jump in here and add a couple of thoughts?
Sure, absolutely.
What's interesting is the philosophy of the top-down method is to avoid the royalty stacking problem. And I use that term in quotes because it's viewed as a problem. Whether it's really a problem, I'm not going to opine on. But the basic concept is the IP should not be some overwhelming percentage of the cost of the product, right? If the product costs $100, you know, the implementer shouldn't be paying 90% of that to the patent holders. That's the concept. And if you do a bottom-up approach, you run into the royalty stacking problem, right? A bottom-up approach says, I have 100 patents. What's this patent worth? Oh, maybe 2%. What's this one worth? 2%. And then you get close to 100. You see the problem. But I would just add that one interesting issue with the top-down approach, the elephant in the room that we haven't talked about yet, is what is the product at issue that you're talking about, that you're doing a percentage of? If, for example, if you're talking about you know, technology relating to, you know, to cell communications? Are you talking about the chip, which is one cost, or are you talking about the telephone, which is a different cost? And, you know, there's a big debate in the among folks in courts with people taking different views as to whether or not FRAND should be based on what's called the smallest saleable patented unit. And even there's the debate is both legal and factual, and it's important to distinguish it. First, there's a legal issue. Do you have to, in the example I gave, do you have to calculate FRAND based on the chip or based on the cell phone? Even if you get past the legal issue, what is patented? Are there some system patents that only come into play when you talk about the phone and not the chip? It's very complicated, and which is why another pitch for arbitration or experts that, you know, patent counting, which is the simplistic approach Shen talked about that some judges do, patent counting may not be the best way to go, but it's certainly simple and easy to understand.
Yeah, thank you, Aldo, for bringing up the smallest saleable patent practicing unit, and its close cousin, the entire market value rule, which is times when you can actually look at the larger product, the cell phone, if you will. And you're right, it's a factual issue. I mean, generally speaking, you want to look at sort of, and again, very, very generally speaking, you know, the sort of the smallest unit you can. Sometimes that gets complicated by just pure data. Is there even a price available for, you know, that you can observe for something that small? How small is small enough? That's another issue. Sometimes judges want you to go to the sort of the smallest price you can see and even go smaller than that. And there's also issues if you are using other licenses to benchmark the royalty at issue. So although maybe it's possible in a phone to get to the level of the chip and maybe even something smaller than the chip, if all the license agreements that you see in the industry are based on the phone or some other subsystem, then how do you translate the licenses that you see into the royalty that you're trying to assess? Do you have to? You know, mathematically, obviously, one can do that. There's a ratio of a value of a larger component to a smaller component. But whether you have to do that legally and then how you do that economically is complicated. So, yeah, definitely, yeah. Definitely a place to get your expert involved early and really sort of hash out these issues. Yeah.
Right. And you brought up the comparable license issue, which is part of the Selna approach. He didn't just do top down. He also looked at comparable licenses. But of course, as you know, Christine, and all of the NERA folks know, comparable is in the eye of the beholder, right? There often licenses are cross licenses. So it's not a naked license to the SEPs. You've got to consider the fact that there's a cross license. So what is really the value given to the SEPs in that cross license? That's why we need experts.
That's exactly right. It's important to disentangle all of that. That's for sure. Aldo, you had mentioned something earlier that I would like to come back to and actually maybe ask Susanna if she could expand on this. And it's the question about arbitration clauses and how they should be drafted. And I'll note that we had a question in the chat that maybe we can weave in here as well. So my question was going to be, you know, what should the drafters of arbitration clauses be thinking about in this world of FRAND, antitrust claims, you know, the difficulty of getting to royalties, all of this, but also how do you actually see that being implemented by standard setting organizations, since they seem to have a reluctance to mandate arbitration clauses in their standard contracts?
Sure, thanks, Christine. So first, I would just say that it's very important for drafters, given the different approaches across jurisdictions, not to make any assumptions or take any shortcuts in saying specifically what you want to be covered in the agreement. So for example, as we touched on earlier, drafters cannot assume that just saying that they want to arbitrate, for example, antitrust issues will mean that a breach of FRAND will be arbitrable or that a FRAND rate will ultimately be set. This all has to be spelled out because, as we noted, the US currently is trending away from the idea that a breach of a FRAND commitment is even an antitrust issue. Otherwise, you may have what has happened in one of our cases where you find yourself with a parallel arbitration proceeding going on at the same time as your litigation, or even worse, you could find that either the arbitration or the litigation is stayed, which means that resolving these disputes is certainly not more efficient, as was your initial goal of going to arbitration. But instead, you might find it, that it drags out even longer with an arbitration and then a litigation, or a litigation and then an arbitration, and now your disputes have taken the better part of a decade, if not more. So that is, of course, what you want to avoid. So just be very clear in what you want in your arbitration agreements. You know, with respect to your second question and the question from the audience in terms of a resistance of SSOs to incorporate arbitration requirements into their IPR policies. You know, first of all, I think that these are just complicated issues. And, you know, this is ultimately a commitment that has to reflect both sides, both, you know, the patent holder's interests as well as the implementer's interests. And I think that, you know, the courts have been moving in one direction. Obviously, Unwired Planet is looking very closely at the Etsy IPR policy specifically, and I suspect other courts will follow in that trend, as well as some US courts I expect to do the same. But I think that this is somewhat of a new concept, and we're just sort of getting to this point. I think that we will see more of these discussions in SSOs, and we will see more of, you know, arbitration as a potential avenue to solve a lot of these inefficiencies and problems that could be very desirable to both patent holders and to implementers. But it really just depends on getting these groups to agree on a common solution.
I would just add that SSOs are political animals like many entities, and they recognize that the patent holders in front of them are also implementers sometimes, right? True. So they don't want to put their thumb on the scale in favor of one or the other. They try to walk a middle ground. Whether they're successful or not depends on who you ask. But I think the feeling is that insisting on arbitration would put the thumb on the scale, perhaps against the patent holders who want the right to go to court in appropriate circumstances. There are some courts that say, look, you know, if the implementer is engaging in what Shang called, you know, patent hold out, maybe you can get an injunction. There are courts that say, you know, bringing an infringement action is not necessarily a breach of a FRAND obligation. That was the Cisco case in the Northern District of Illinois. So the point is, going to court is not necessarily a breach of FRAND, even if you've been going through a standard setting organization. So I think that's the concern. If I could, I don't know, Christine, there are more questions in the chat. I don't know whether you want to handle those or not.
Yeah, I think we will. I just wanted to tack on one thing to what Susanna said about, you know, the carefully crafting sort of the arbitration proceedings. It comes out of a arbitration matter that I just recently worked on. And that is You know, as all of these contracts are being, especially if they involve IP, are being drafted, oftentimes, obviously, it's lawyers. Hopefully, it's also business people. But I'd encourage you to have somebody on the team that has an economic or a valuation type of background. Can be, you know, someone on your legal team, can be someone on the business side. Because what I see, and I mean, you know, the amount of money that gets spent on this for loosely defined economic terms in contracts, what I see oftentimes is that the writers of contracts, it must be the case, they think that certain terms are well defined, and yet they're not. There's no specific definition. And so then millions of dollars get spent on something like, for example, I had a recent case that involved the question of fair market value. I guess to somebody who's not, you know, trained in this area, you must think that that's obvious what fair market value is. Well, let me tell you, it's absolutely not. And without clear guidance as to what was meant by the drafters when they talk about fair market value in different constructs in different areas of the contract, like I said, you know, the millions and millions of dollars that were spent in arbitrating that. So, you know, to have someone on that team that really is reading the contract also with especially if there are economic or valuation terms in there, with that hat on and saying, is this well-defined enough? I can't stress that enough. Of course, not having them defined gives me more work, but in the interest of your clients. We had a couple of good questions from the audience. I don't know how many we'll get to, but maybe I'll start with the last one. The role of mediation in, you know, FRAN disputes. We've been focusing on the question of arbitration versus litigation. But maybe Susanna or Aldo, you could speak a little bit about how you've seen mediation fit into that dispute resolution as well.
I'll just start with a practical point. Just like Nira will be familiar with this concept. There are good experts and bad experts. There are good mediators and bad mediators. I think mediation can work with a forceful mediator who will point out the issues that each side has. And so it's certainly worth exploring. And many folks, I'm dealing with a situation that's similar right now. Many folks put a mediation precondition in their arbitration clauses, which can also save some money. So that's my practical advice.
I would just note that, you know, in our practice, we often see mediation, but it is often an add-on, not something offered instead of arbitration or litigation. So it can be helpful to point out, you know, strengths and weaknesses of a particular position or argument, but it often at the end of the day does not actually create more efficiencies.
Great. Well, I'd like to really open the floor to, I think, a really interesting question that has come up that a couple of our panelists were bantering about before too, which is this new executive order by President Biden that wades into this area of antitrust. And so, you know, what effect is that going to have on FRAN generally and on this move that we're seeing, at least in part, to move FRAN cases, either to resolve them internationally, whether it be through local courts, as we've talked about in certain circumstances, or through arbitration? Aldo, do you want to kick us off? And then I invite everyone to join in. I'm sure everyone has a view on this.
Sure. I don't remember the exact Yogi Berra quote, but it was something like, predicting the future involves looking forward, so I'm not going to do it. But I will say one thing. So I'm not going to predict what happens, but I will urge people to keep this in mind when they're thinking about what the administration will do about FRAN disputes. Not all FRAN disputes come in the same flavor. And what I mean by that is Oftentimes you have what I call a plain vanilla FRAND dispute where implementer says, you know, patent holder is not offering me a FRAND rate and therefore I've been legally harmed. Is that an antitrust violation? I think the better view is no, it's not. But there's another flavor of a FRAND dispute, which is what happens in there's an old case, some of you may remember, a Rambis type case where actual fraud was perpetrated on the SSO by the patent holder. Maybe the patent holder didn't disclose certain patents, withheld materials that the SSO should have known before the standard was issued. And then there's a FRAND dispute. Is that an antitrust violation? I mean, without answering that question, I would say, you know, the regulators are likely to look at those in very different ways. And so when predicting the future, I would keep in mind that you're talking about many different types of conduct.
I would just jump in here. This obviously is an area where Aldo and I could spend more than an hour discussing all of this. I think that there is a tendency of commentators to look at the executive order and think that everything that has happened under Macon Del Rahim will be automatically reversed and changed overnight. I think that is a huge overstatement. And I think that the wording of the executive order is actually quite narrow and looks at using market power to extend it beyond the scope of your patents. I think that is something very different from what has already been decided in several courts in the US, that a FRAND contractual dispute is a contractual dispute and not an antitrust issue. I think for the DOJ itself, it's very important to show consistency that businesses can rely on and continuity. And while we have seen some significant disputes over the last several years across even the sister agencies between the FTC and the DOJ, I think that with respect to whether a FRAND breach is itself an antitrust issue or a contract issue, you can't underestimate the role of the courts. And the FTC has not been asked to come up with new, promulgate new rules specific to this discrete issue.
So in terms of injunctions, I think, the executive order makes it even less likely that you're going to be able to secure an injunction in the U.S. when you're talking about standard and essential patents that, you know, where they have to follow FRAND licensing terms.
Okay. I'll just want to add one quick point about the antitrust angle for this, which is, I think I mentioned this earlier, but I think it's not right to think like FRAND would automatically be or not be a antitrust issue. A antitrust issue occurs if there's market power and there's some assessment that there's going to be competitive impact, there's going to be reduced competition or harm to consumers, right? So FRAND, the fact that it's FRAND or the fact that it's a standard central patent, that doesn't automatically make give you market power or not market power. If you take one step back, just intellectual property in general, a patent gives the owner ability to exclude, and it's called like a patent monopoly. Like they use the term, but it's not the antitrust monopoly. It just says for this specific patent, whoever owns it, they have the exclusive right to that technology, and they can choose to license. With a standard essential patent, it extends to a standard of technology that's being used. But that doesn't necessarily mean that even the standard has market power. There are competing standards. You need to assess all of that. And there needs to be a proper assessment for what exactly is the conduct, how is competition being affected. You need to look at the facts. So I don't think like, yeah, so I would say, like, be careful about, like, lumping things into either antitrust or not antitrust. Antitrust is its own assessment for whether it qualifies.
Great, thanks. Well, since we're talking about sort of big picture questions, we have another good one, and that is the relationship of the COVID-19 pandemic and the associated global economic crisis, and whether or not that calls for a review of FRAND policies. And I'll maybe start on that. I think FRAND typically shows up on the high tech side, not on the life sciences side. And when we think about IP as related to COVID-19, we're mostly thinking about the life sciences side, in particular vaccines, right? There's been a lot of questions about, compulsory licensing and royalty-free patents as related to the vaccine. So that's not really going to come up in the COVID-19 setting. And I think if you look at, more broadly, I don't think there's anybody who's said, I certainly haven't seen suggestions that in any way sort of economic efficiency more generally, or, the global economic crisis is kind of affected by FRAND licensing or not licensing under FRAND. If anything, the high tech sector seems to be, one of those places that keeps moving forward. I mean, Zoom, for example, during the pandemic. So I don't think that there's, a close tie. I mean, I'm sure somebody could find a way to weave them together, and I certainly invite the panelists to do so, but I wouldn't see FRAND and COVID-19 as being the two things that go together. I would see them more, on sort of the long-term high-tech issues and high-tech, and frankly, at some points in time, it's going to probably dovetail more with things like privacy and standards that relate to the keeping of data private and all of that, and then how that all interacts with FRAN and the public interest questions that are being answered a little bit differently in the U.S. and Europe, which could give rise to some cross-country differences.
Yeah, the only other COVID-19 comment I would make, Christine, is we're talking really about FRAN licensing of patents. And when you get into the vaccines and all that, you're getting into a lot of trade secret issues as well, that, the trade secrets are what's really needed in many cases to produce the actual vaccines. So it goes way beyond just the, licensing of patents. And of course, once the trade secret is publicly known, it loses all of its value from being held as a secret.
Yeah, I would just add, I agree. I don't think that COVID is going to lead to a reevaluation of FRAND in this context. I think that, we have to be careful not to make these sort of political hops from one area to another. And we really have to ensure that we do not undermine the incentives that we need to continue to spur research and development and investments in what is going to ultimately lead to a complete revolution of our technology in the decades to come.
Does anyone else want to wade into the big picture questions? Or otherwise, there are a couple of questions that were a little bit more specific, but I thought we'd have a little fun with the big picture. Well, then let's go back to a specific. I think we have a few more minutes, and I'm sure the organizers will jump in when they need to with CLE codes and the like. But there's a question that came in, and I think this was touched on a little bit, but perhaps I'd ask the lawyers to expand a bit more. If anyone could expand on the international enforceability of a worldwide FRAND determination if it comes out of a court judgment versus an arbitration award. Alto or Susanna, could either one of you address that?
Sure, I can start. I think U.S. courts are very protective of their jurisdiction. And I think you might have a tough time trying to enforce a foreign court judgment purporting to determine what a rate on a U.S. patent is supposed to be in a U.S. court. Now, that's just my prediction. I think arbitration is probably easier to enforce, especially if you know you've got the New York Convention relating to the enforcement of arbitration awards, where if the countries are party to the treaty, you can enforce the award in any country that's part of the treaty. And it's very difficult to overturn an arbitration award. It's manifest disregard of the law. I mean, there is an outlier case. I forget the name of it, but there was an outlier case where a New York court refused to enforce an arbitration award because the parties had said, you can apply basically no law, whatever you want. And the court said that's not consistent with the convention. So I would encourage parties to pick a law that should be applied. But once you do that and go to arbitration, it's very difficult to overturn the arbitration award.
All right, Susanna, any other thoughts?
I would just add that, you know, Aldo mentioned that some jurisdictions like the US are protective of their jurisdiction. There are some global jurisdictions that are more protective of their particular companies that are national companies. I won't name names, but probably everyone knows what I'm talking about. You know, I think if you are specific and you say what law should apply, what jurisdiction you should ultimately be in an arbitral agreement, you may ultimately have a better chance of really getting that true global fringe determination, because there is always a risk that certain jurisdictions will favor their own national entities.
Okay, well, let me ask just in the few minutes that we have remaining, there have been a few questions on the use of WIPO dispute settlement mechanisms for settling FRAND disputes. That's outside of my wheelhouse, so I will turn that over to somebody who knows what that question means.
That's the World Intellectual Property Organization. I have not used their dispute settlement mechanisms, so I cannot comment, unfortunately.
Nor have I. Aldo and I work together, so.
Your best bet was with lawyers.
Sorry about that, but if anyone wants to, you know, if the questioners want to send us an email, or we probably have your email, what we can do is we can certainly ask around within our firm, and I'm sure Aldo and Susanna can as well, and we can get back in touch with you and suggest somebody who might be able to answer your questions. So apologies for that, for the WIPO questions. And I think that's what we have. And so I think it's time to wrap up. I'll just give our panelists, another 15 seconds or so if they want to just go around and any closing comments or thoughts before we turn it back over to our organizers. Let's start with our economist, maybe. Christopher?
Yeah, I just wanted to thank everyone for tuning in today. And again, if you have any questions, you should have our contact information, or it's easily obtainable. And we look forward to hearing from you.
Shane, do you want to?
All right. Yeah. So again, really enjoyed working with everyone on the panel. I think broadly my thoughts on the issue is that as an economic matter, it makes a lot of sense to go to arbitration as opposed to individual litigation in 20 different districts. Overall, I guess it generates fewer billable hours for economists and lawyers, but for moving the world forward, I think it makes sense that things are going towards arbitration.
I would just say that while hopefully Susanna and I are experts on the law, we appreciate the importance and need for experts on the economics, because FRAND is a very complicated area that is not just legal, it's economic. And that's the challenge faced by the courts who have to grapple with both legal issues and economic issues. And another benefit or potential benefit of arbitration if you've got the right decision makers.
So I would just add that while I think arbitration does provide hope for the future in this particular area, I do think, unfortunately, things are going to get more complex globally for a while before they really start to get better. So this is a very evolving, changing area. 2020 was a very busy year in this area, and we expect this year to continue on along that trend. If anyone has any questions about these complexities or issues or strategies that they're dealing with, please feel free to reach out to us. And finally, I just want to thank NARA. I want to thank everyone who has worked hard to put this event together. We appreciate being involved. And we are grateful, personally, I will say I'm grateful for all of the support NARA has given us in our other litigation. So thank you for that.
And thank you to our friends at NIAC for co-hosting this.
Absolutely. So let me wrap up by thanking all of our panelists. I'm sure if this were in person, we would have a large round of applause. So I will do that on behalf of all of you who are attending. Thank you to our panelists. They put in an enormous amount of work getting all this information and also getting you the materials that you'll have gotten by now that give you all the case details and some great reading materials to delve into this topic further. And so with that, I turn back over to our organizers.
Thank you. This was a great presentation, very engaged audience, as well as a panel. So thank you to everyone for attending. And now the moment you've been waiting for. Our CLE password is 10021. Again, the password is 10021. Once you leave the webinar, a survey will pop up where you may enter your information to receive CLE credit, also provide feedback on the presentation. And with that,
Pam, not to interrupt, but the CLE code is different on the screen than what you just read.
I apologize. Thank you. 10122. That would be a typo on my part. 10122. Thank you, Chris. And thank you to everyone. Have a great day.
Thank you.